Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more UNITY. Cool.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, we'll embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and
right
the fighting.
Right now, right now.
Now we're down to do the right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right.
Right now.
We got to have peace, you all. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and yes, we have to have peace. We are in troubled times, guys. We are definitely in troubled times. This is a show that brings folks who are fighting on the various battlefields, whether it be education, human rights, housing. It's so many fronts that we're fighting on, guys, and it's important that we stay there. So democracy seems to be at risk these days on both the local, state, and federal levels. So we definitely have some work to do. No doubt about it. Some work to do, to be done. I want to, before I bring on my esteemed guest today, I want to talk to you about what's going on down in Jefferson City. This, we have a few proposed legislation that is going through the system down there. It's going through the process, the legislative process. But there's one that's very important. Well, two. One of them is around local control of the St. Louis Police Department. But they are really trying to strip citizens of their participation in their own government. So SJR 74 is to get rid of the ballot initiative. And I don't know if people understand the ballot initiative, but that is where citizens get a chance to get signatures. If they get enough, they can get a particular issue on the ballot. That's how we've gotten expansion of Medicaid. That's how we've gotten increase of the minimum wage. And this is what I really love about the ballot initiative, because when we go talk to people and we go get those signatures, their signature is not in favor of the issue. Their signature says this has a right to be on the ballot for citizens to vote for. So that's the beauty of it. So, you know, well, all the ballot initiative is closed, but, you know, they're trying to get the right to free and fair abortions on the ballot. So they were collecting signatures for that. So when people sign, you don't have to be for abortion. You don't even have to be against an abortion. You can just say, yes, I think this deserves to be on the ballot for all Missourians to vote on it. That is what's being taken away, y'all. Our senators who have been in favor of this have been on the floor for over 45 hours filibustering. This is a nonpartisan issue, guys. This is nonpartisan. We need to take that phone in our hands, or, you know, you can email your senators to say, please continue the filibustering. This is not something that we want, and let's see how this all works out. This is Senate JR 74, and you can hear the live debate. You can hear them doing the filibustering. And so, yeah, we want to make sure our legislators know that we are behind them. We, the citizens, we want to be an active participant in our government, in this democracy. And so this is very important for us to continue to do that. So we're going to keep our eyes and ears on that, but I want to introduce Jack Wendell. And you probably have heard that name before, because when we had Lois Conley here a few months ago, she talked about what was going on at the Griot, and that right now we have a initiative on behalf of Alice Windham. And Alice is Jack's sister. So they come from a family of educators. In fact, a third generation of educators. And so Jack has been an educator. He's been a school administrator. He's been advocate on so many different levels. Yeah, so Jack Windham, welcome to Voices from the Battlefield.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Jamala.
So we are here because I wanted you to be on the show to talk about the 70th anniversary of, you know, Brown versus the Kansas Board of Education. And people may need a little refresher on that because that was in 1954, I believe. So this is a case of families that were in Topeka that their kids were still going to segregated schools. They may not have minded that, except that the segregated schools were far closer to the neighborhood, and the other schools were far away, and so these kids were going to have to walk to get to their school. And in 1951, they filed a class action suit against the Board of Education, City of Topeka, and there were 13 parents on behalf of their 20 children, and Linda Carol Brown was a third grader. She was one of those children who had to walk six blocks to her bus stop to ride to her segregated school, which was a mile away, while Sumner High School, which was white, was only seven blocks away. So people probably don't remember or know that Linda Brown was not the only child. Like I said, there were 20 children. How her name got associated with the suit was because they did it in alphabetical order. So Brown was one of the first names, to be on the class action lawsuit. But, you know, we had our astute attorney, who filed this case, none other than Thurgood Marshall. It had to be argued twice, but they won. And the ruling became the law of the land. So that's how we got Brown versus Topeka. Sometimes it's Brown versus Kansas. But that was to desegregate schools all over the U.S. Now, what we're going to talk about, Jack, is what has happened since then. Because obviously we've had a segregation of schools, because most of the schools in the black communities are predominantly black, unless they got some form of magnet school. So that was supposed to get rid of all of the, you know, racial disparities. And one of the things that we know, unfortunately, was that they were able to keep segregation because they were, you know, using the another Supreme Court ruling, Plessy versus Ferguson, and we got, you know, where we saw that the more affluent schools were having advanced placement courses, they got new technology, they got great teachers, renovated facilities, while in the black and brown neighborhoods, they had significantly less. And so what has been your take? Where have we gone since, you know, Brown versus Topeka? Where are we now in 2024 with the school systems, public school systems?
Well, just let me precede my general comment with this. I look through that event not as an isolated event, but as integral to the continuum of black struggle for social justice and full citizenship. So that was a piece of history that is related to all that preceded it and all that has followed it since in relating to educating black children. Clearly, the Supreme Court in the Brown decision, in the Brown case, was actually five cases from various places in the United States that the court decided to name as the one case, the Brown case. The Supreme Court decision to do away with separate but equal, which was the Plessy versus Ferguson, to do away with that and say that it violated the 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law to continue with segregated schools. A lot of resistance to that occurred. It took almost 2 years before the court had to come up with yet another decision, and that was letting the federal court system know you will oversee and you will take up litigation to enforce this decision, because the resistance was considerable. Mm-hmm. A lot of tension, even in the St. Louis area.
Right.
So that second court decision was the one that really put things on the front page. And a lot of good things came out of the decision. It improved educational opportunities for many blacks, improved school funding that blacks were able to benefit from, class sizes got reduced, improved academic achievement by blacks, diminished the imbalance between black and white performance, according to one researcher, by 50%, improved graduation rates. And I think, importantly, it improves social contact between black and white youth in a space which they could become acquainted with one another and form friendships and reduce racial tension. But all that took time. And it created a climate in which whites could get to know blacks better and vice versa, kind of helped mitigate some of the negative mythologies of race. Because blacks were viewed as inferior, period. Which was one strong justification for not wanting them to ruin the white schools. That was a prevalent view among whites. When the desegregation orders got lifted in the early 1990s and early 2000s, a lot more had occurred. You started to get changing economic conditions. You got demographic shifts. And schools got resegregated. According to Rucker Johnson, who's a professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, the schools have resegregated. We now have major segregated schools that have put us back into the dilemma of how do we get our black children a quality education so that they can be competitive and active participants for opportunities in the world of work. The pushback right now has been exacerbated by the pandemic, which took kids out of school. The last thing that our black kids needed was to be out of school trying to engage in education through some remote learning process. Hmm. That has been a challenge that has set our efforts back. But again, this is all in the continuum of struggle. So that isn't just an isolated piece of our history in trying to get young blacks, our youth, into schools, not just so that there's a daykeeping or a housekeeping situation with them, keep them off the street, but so that they could learn and be competitive in opportunity for higher education and for employment. And so we really are in a terrible place right now, with many teachers having given up, mm-hmm. retired,
mm-hmm.
and we're using substitute teachers in classrooms. Some school districts in our area have large numbers of vacancies for certified teachers being filled by substitutes. This is a major hurdle for us.
And Jack, I'm
going to. But
gonna,
the reality.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, please.
No. I'm going to. We're going to take a deeper dive into that. But I wanted to go back to May 17th, 1954, when we were celebrating Brown versus the Kansas Board of Education, and all that you said that we got as a result of that. I mean, it was definitely all pluses. I'm wondering, what did you see as some of the downfalls of of desegregation or the way that we desegregated the schools? Were there any downsides to it?
I think that there were, and I'll just use a personal family example since I'm so familiar with it. My grandfather had been the principal of the black school in Edwardsville, Illinois, Lincoln. And when this downside came in Edwardsville, right over there where SIUE Edwardsville is, they fired every black teacher and administrator in order to bring about integration.
Wow.
And some of the teachers were able to reapply for positions and did get teaching positions in the school system. But one of the things that was done, as was related to me by a family member who was going into his senior year at the time this occurred, was the teachers on the Lincoln faculty offered additional schooling for them, for those seniors that were going to be going to the new high school, additional instruction so that they could be competitive. They were not required to attend the sessions, but the students were really appreciative, because there was a sense even among our own black children that they were inferior to white kids.
Exactly.
In terms of their ability to compete in the classroom. But the payoff of that was that those students at Lincoln High School, those black students who received that instruction and were willing to show up for it, they finished in the top part of their class at the white high school. So they demonstrated that excellence was occurring in their all-black school and that they could compete well.
So let me just ask, interrupt for a minute, Jack. So was that the doings of the parents, or was that a Board of Education policy to provide that extra for the black kids?
That was the doing of the teachers at Lincoln, who had a lot vested in those students.
Okay.
And you know, at that point in time, for many black teachers, where they were really able to bask in the light of their professional efforts was by identifying their top students and pouring themselves into them so that they could go out and bask in their light as they did well in college and in the world of work. So it was a big deal for them to be willing to say, I'm being fired from my job, but I care enough about you, and I care, and I see you as a way for me to vindicate my own, validate my own efforts, that you're a good student and you can shine. And many of these teachers that we had in that time frame were really very well-educated folks. And they brought to the classroom some really fine teaching. That was a different period because there was very little for educated blacks to do, college-educated blacks to do, but go teach.
Right, right.
In general. So that was one of the things that happened. There was a lot of anger in Edwardsville within that former teaching corps. But they were, their efforts were validated by how well their students did eventually over at Edwardsville.
Wow.
Now, these were not white kids and black kids that didn't know each other. They lived in the same neighborhood.
Exactly, exactly.
In many instances.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew each other. But this idea of being made to feel that you are superior and that these folks are inferior, that was not something ignored by many white students in my own experience in education. This sense of superiority founded on nothing but mythology of black inferiority.
Exactly.
So at WashU, I experienced the same thing with many white students, many black students coming to WashU at the time, and this is well after that desegregation decision, who really felt that they were not as capable as the white students. It was really something to observe.
Right, so, right. It's painful, isn't it? It's really painful.
It's angering.
Mm-hmm.
It is angering, and it's painful. Mm-hmm. I will tell you a quick story. of how bad it was for blacks. When my mother was, my mother by age three had read all Greek mythology in English print. She was extraordinarily gifted, studied by the University of Chicago and the University of Illinois. So when she went to the University of Illinois at an early age, her first experience with the idea that she might be inferior was when she was given her first English paperback graded, and she had a B. She had never seen a B in her life on anything she had done. Mm. And she said, she asked the professor, why was my paper graded at this level? And he says, because using the N-word is not worth more than a B.
Wow.
Now, for her, that was a shock to the system about a piece of reality that her parents had never tried to inculcate her with understanding.
Right, right.
But ever since then, it set her on a battle. And it's not an uncommon experience.
No, not at all. In various ways, in various places. So,
yes.
Yeah, so those are some excellent examples, Jack. And I'm wondering, too, when I looked at desegregation and some of the negative byproducts of it, one of them was that black students in those desegregated spaces were treated unfairly from the sense of, you know, the punishment was harsher. So then it gave rise to this whole movement around really trying to look at how those schools were distinguishing policies around black students, and particularly the black males. The other thing that I took note of is, and this happened more in the South, and I heard this from teachers, including a family member, that when they desegregated there, the black schools were closed and lost the names of their black heroes and sheroes. So in order to continue obliterating, you know, our history, those schools were pretty much abandoned. And so if you wanted to go to a desegregated school and the district says, here's the new school, it was no longer going to have the name of a Frederick Douglass or, one of the other, historic figures that we would be looking to. The other thing I remember is that in some cases, the students said that they were treated unfairly in the classroom, much like your mom. Like, you could never get a B. But it also manifested itself in when our black students were raised their hand to be called upon, they were totally ignored as if they weren't even in the classroom. And I can't tell you, Jack, how many kids that I've talked to who were part of the St. Louis DSEG program, years later, when they would tell stories, they would break down. So this was traumatic for them. And I would ask them, I said, did you tell your parents how those teachers were making you feel or how they were treating you? And most of them said no, because they felt like it was something that they were doing because their parents had sent them there. Their parents had sent them to schools that were supposed to be better than the schools that they went to. So for them to come back and start complaining, they felt like they didn't have the right to, or they didn't have evidence. And so they just suffered silently. Now, some of them didn't. Some of them were like, you know, raised hell in court. So they were suspended or were always in detention or, you know, sent back to St. Louis public schools. But it seems like psychologically that our children, you know, they didn't fare well under the DSEG programs.
And I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not surprised that the children had difficulty. You know, when teachers are so important to youngsters, especially in the elementary level, a kid will come home and say to his parent, "Well, my teacher said so." Mm. I mean, we'll challenge the parent's response to something by saying, "My teacher said so." If a teacher levied a criticism, like, well, you're never going to be successful. I mean, this is a youngster developing and getting feedback from someone that he or she deems important in their lives. And so you can kill a kid's spirit. Even a parent can kill a kid's spirit by that kind of criticism. I have no doubt many hurtful things mm-hmm. have been said to students. My granddaughter came home, and she went to one of the very prominent schools here in St. private schools here in St. Louis, and out in Clayton, private school. And she was, I said, well, how'd school go today? And she was about the sixth or seventh grade. And she said, went okay. I said, what are you working on? She said, we're working on westward expansion, the pioneers for westward expansion in the country. And I said, well, what have you learned? She said, well, I learned that there's no black pioneers.
Mm.
I said, I beg your pardon? I said, where did you learn that? She said, my teacher told me that there were no black pioneers. They were just slaves doing what their white masters told them to do. So that they are not considered to be the pioneers.
Wow.
I said, I said, where's this teacher from of yours right here? She's from Louisiana. I said, oh, okay. Now, I didn't want her to see my anger. I said, I'm saving this for her mother when she gets here to pick you up. So when she came, I explained to her. Well, the next day, her mother was at the school. And the teacher and the head of school got an education from her mother. Now, this is a mother who's well-educated.
Wow.
But her daughter was being told by her teacher, and she was going to tell me there were no black pioneers.
Mm-mm-mm.
So that is the kind of thing, it's a form of miseducation. But it's done, I don't want to make any excuses for the teacher, but the teacher herself was probably ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
And had been educated to think that way. So I think it's important whenever, and it's just too bad, Jamal, that our parents, many of our parents, were not well educated. And they were really not prepared to be the educational advocates for their children. And in fact, a very prevalent thought in our black community back in that time frame was if it's white, it's right.
Right. Exactly. And you know, the other thing about, it's not just the level of education, it's the level of access. And sometimes the parents of these kids had negative experience themselves, so they were alienated from the school system or the educational system. And, you know, for those who had some degree of understanding, they were bogged down with, you know, trying to make ends meet, two or three jobs. And so, you know, our children just, I mean, when I think about school, for me, that was the place. You know, that was the place that I wanted to go. And, you know, I know that's not the case now, because what we're experiencing in a number of surveys and educational research has said that the number of kids, black and brown, that are pulling away from school is frightening. And so I don't know how we deal with this, and perhaps it's not exactly sure why this is happening, but they're choosing not to go. And all I can think of, Jack, is these kids see that this is a hostile environment, it's a violent environment, and they're just choosing to stay at home. And parents are allowing them to do it. Now, one of the things, I want to go back to the COVID-19, the pandemic, because I do think that estranged students from the school. Do you think that the pandemic was, for us in St. Louis, was worse than the Roberti era, which completely, like, gutted the schools, demoralized teachers and administrators? It just seems like people just don't have the enthusiasm about education that I think they should have, and that's across the board.
Yeah, the Roberti era was terrible. There's no question that it was devastating, and with purpose. the pandemic is something that is a public health issue that's crept in, into all of our lives. When you and I went to school, though, you know, but nevertheless, when I went, before I went to school, you had to have all your shots. Mm-hmm. It was just that simple. Mm-hmm.
And for us, you know, when I went, you got your shots in the gymnasium. You lined up.
Yeah. You got your tuberculosis right. test and everything was done. You got your salt vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
But something has crept into our lives, our public lives, about vaccines. And a lot of it is not false in terms of the belief of the damage that can be done to you mm-hmm. by taking vaccines. There was a fundamental basis for having concern because mercury was being used as a carrier component, and mercury was known to be damaging.
Right. Poison to the
system. So the information age and social platforms have transformed how people feel about a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, clearly, a lot of people that formerly we would have said, you know, they need to be institutionalized, have now found on social platforms people that think just like they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of challenge to being wrong or to being right about anything because somebody can cite something that just is not factually true, but it gets around and you believe it.
Yeah.
I have friends who are trained in the sciences at the graduate level who will not take vaccines
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because they feel as though the research behind them was accelerated too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just been rather in awe.
Yeah.
My military career exposed me to getting shots all the time, any place I was going mm-hmm. in an overseas area. And so I'm comfortable with it. But it is a piece that is very relevant to the education of our children. I don't want anybody, I'm looking at it from a teacher's perspective, I don't want anybody in my classroom who having an opportunity for immunizations to protect us all, as well as himself or herself, not having parents that don't want them to have it, but want them in school.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's a piece of antagonism I would not want.
Right, right.
As a teacher. So it affects us. It affects how our kids interpret things. I don't know how we get around it without better education. And I'm talking about now for parents.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's the parents that kind of help set the tone for the kids' attitude at school.
Right, right.
But
don't you think
so
that was an opportunity for us to really, a teachable moment for us to really talk about the pandemic? This was something that most people had never experienced. We hadn't had one for, 100 and something years. And so to
right.
me, I mean, I really struggle with it like you say you did, Jack. You know, you have a parent that says, respect my right to not get my child vaccinations because of the history of, you know, this, that, and the other, but I want them to be in the classroom. So here you are, you know, really trying to weigh the safety of all the kids, as you said, and wondering who has more rights than the others because all of them still got thrust into a classroom, regardless. But the other thing that, you know, I had a group of teachers from all over the country, on the show to really talk about COVID, the impact on them, the impact on their teaching, the impact on their students. And one of the things that they all agreed on, and some of them were from the St. Louis Public Schools, was that they did not get adequate training. They did not get an adequate understanding of what this thing was and how it was going to impact the kids, not just academically, but psychologically. And so, and technologically, because, you know, for some parents, they never had interacted with a computer in this way before, but yet we were saying, now you have to log them in, and you have to do this, and you have to do that. They just felt like they were just woefully unprepared for what was coming down the pipe.
And they were. They were unprepared. They felt that way because they were that way. I won't mention the school district, but a friend of mine who's a counselor in one school district received a call from a parent, and she said, they gave me one Chromebook.
Mm.
one computer per family. She said, I have 9 children. She said, all of them are in some level of schooling. They cannot use this one Chromebook, this computer. And what can I do? She said, call the principal. And if you don't get satisfaction, call the superintendent. But you are exactly right. This will never work with a family being given a Chromebook as opposed to every student mm-hmm. being required to have one to do their work.
Wow.
It was a novel kind of thing because it takes it. It's like what's called the self probably. It's that kind of study where you move at your own.
Oh, Montessori.
Pace. Yeah. Well, I'm really talking about for higher levels of education. Even it takes a very disciplined person to sit down to a computer and take a course.
Mm-hmm.
And be disciplined. Now, that's a very disciplined, mature person.
Mm-hmm.
But for a child, sitting down and looking at the computer is boring.
Unless they're playing a game.
And when things reach the point over here in my school district where they couldn't get enough teachers, certified teachers, into the classroom, they had to conceptualize a remote learning approach where the one teacher would teach many students who were under the supervision of a substitute teacher for assistance.
Mm.
Because they didn't have enough teachers to cover the classes.
Wow.
I mean, this is devastating for us. The last thing we need are high pupil-to-teacher ratios. We need reasonable pupil-to-teacher ratios. And some of the thinking in education is simply archaic, given the challenges. We've got these classrooms of these of a wide range of learning abilities in a classroom
mm-hmm.
because of mainstreaming
mm-hmm.
Of special ed kids into the classroom. So this idea of getting away from having homogeneous classrooms, kids pretty close to one another in learning, and going to heterogeneous classrooms and perhaps resourcing them more, had real budget constraints to it. So the challenges that our kids face in school, some are related to their lack of eagerness or readiness for learning, but a lot of it is the terrible structure for learning that's in our schools, given the needs of the children that come to our schools.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a, you know, all of that was compounded by this bit of teachers saying no. You know, just to give you an example of how parents can be left out of what happens to their children. At the Normandy High School, where at one time they got rid of almost, when the collaborative got involved and the district was taken over, they got rid of over 60% of the teachers in the high school and brought in a great many teachers from Teach for America.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not last long.
Of course.
Because anybody who believes that teaching and learning is simply about pouring knowledge into the head of a student, a personality as though they were a vessel of some kind, they don't understand the dynamic of teaching and learning in the classroom. The importance of having a teacher that is a personality, that has feelings, that can relate to students and the challenges that they have with learning. But we have too many folks that believe my only job is to teach. And what's occurred is the emphasis that we have placed on testing has destroyed relationships between teachers and students. Mm. If you can't give me good test scores, I don't have much time for you.
Right, right.
Well, you know, so that's
you know, I think when you talked about the Normandy thing, about, you know, because at one point our the St. Louis Public Schools was unaccredited. But I wanted to go back in case people didn't. When we said Roberti, the Roberti era, who William
yeah.
Roberti is, because the name for those folks of us who are around will send chills up your spine. And he came in about 2000, brought in here to clean up, fix up. He got the nickname Demolition Man. He was a former Brooks Brother executive, had no experience with schools, especially
mm-hmm.
public schools, not a iota. Yet he came in here. Okay, he trimmed the budget by $80 million, but to what end, and it seemed like it was very arbitrary. He also closed about, 20 schools, most of them on the north side, and most of them are still vacant today. So when you talk about Roberta, his legacy is one of destruction, which I think the St. Louis public schools never recovered from. I really don't. And then here you come with COVID. I'm just, when it comes to this kind of stuff, Jack, I'm just like beside myself. But I do want to ask you, what do you think, or how are we going to regroup from COVID? Because it seems like the St. Louis Public Schools and maybe other districts, but I'm more in tune to what that district is doing, that they have moved on. Now, the national research says that these kids are going to be, the COVID has put them behind 1 to 3 years.
Easily.
So I'm thinking, okay, what do we have in place to complement what we would already be doing so that these kids get back up to par? I see nothing. Please tell me that I'm missing something here, because these kids are going to be far, and maybe that's the reason why they are, you're saying bye-bye so long, because they are so far behind that they know they'll never catch up.
You feel good when you know you're a learner, you raise your hand, you know the answer to the question, you're getting good grades on your paper. Let me answer the question you posed, because it's all related in the continuum of our struggle. If we go back to the Brown versus Topeka Board of Education, we find ourselves at that point dealing with separate but equal. As though this word equal means something to us. And for us as a black people, we knew white people had it better, so that if we were going to be going to their schools with them, to the extent that they could accommodate us, then we knew that we were going to be getting something better, because white was the measure.
Mm-hmm.
Not understanding or really giving any thought to what equal meant. So what it meant to some degree, to a great degree, was you got the same facilities, you got certified teachers, you don't have the same facilities, you got facilities, you got certified teachers, you got funding, so make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now.
Mm-hmm.
When they made the Brown decision, a big piece of that was the Dahl experiment by that Thurgood Marshall brought, by Clark.
Wow.
The psychologist Clark.
Yes.
And that Dahl experiment showed that psychological damage was occurring in segregated schools. Black girls habitually chose as their preference over black dolls. They chose white dolls. And so those experiments, the results were enough for the court to say, hey, this is something really going on with this separate education. Now, that was one piece of it. Another piece of that ultimate decision that the Chief Justice Warren was able to put together was tied to the fact that overseas, this beacon of democracy over here had a major dilemma, and that is, look how you are treating black people. How do you reconcile that with your Democratic Republic ideas? So there was some real international concern in terms of our footprint and standing in the international order. Warren managed to get everybody to get on board. Now, the word equal is still being used
mm-hmm.
in the thought, because when you look at the funding of, well, let's just stay with Missouri, but it's no different than many of the states. They look at equal funding formula. You get, you know, the funding formula applies in Clayton, Ladue,
mm-hmm.
St. Louis City,
mm-hmm.
Normandy,
mm-hmm.
you know, as though, well, what are we talking about with this equal? Clearly, and this is where I think there's some nefarious practices afoot. Clearly, there's a difference between the urban child, the suburban child, and the rural child.
Absolutely.
So what makes anybody think some notion of one size fits all equal should be applicable when looking at how we're going to fund our schools? Because we're supposed to be preparing our youngsters to be citizens and for the world of work. Well, the word clearly, when you look at the disparities between the needs of urban children, it's not like these needs are fixed. Look at the urban decay in St. Louis City, the vacant lots, the schools that are shuttered, and they're disgraceful in some neighborhoods. They should be torn down. All of that is still dealing, and the school board has a responsibility to maintain those schools. Well, all of this is dealing with an idea in Jefferson City of feeding our school districts, and I think there are over 400 districts in the state, in some equal fashion. No. If you're serious about being responsive to the developmental needs of children and the developmental needs of communities and of homes and of neighborhoods, then you can't be talking about equality. You must be standing on a platform of equity. And a platform of equity says, we are going to assess your needs in a comprehensive way, and we're going to respond to you to be supportive of achieving the desired educational outcomes for these children. That's not the way it works.
No, it isn't.
And right now, clearly, the St. Louis City has a major challenge with its youths, not only in their neighborhoods, in their homes, in the community at large, but in the schools. And no one, and yet, the way budget shortfalls are dealt with normally is about just increasing pupil-teacher ratios. So let a teacher work with rather a reasonable number of 15 or 16, let them work with 25 or 30. Well, that immediately says the child is not what's important in this equation in terms of fulfillment of the response, constitutional responsibility to deliver a quality education to our children. And it can't be about just bricks and mortars and instructional technology. It has to take into account what are the needs of urban youth. How do they contrast with the suburban or the rural? Well, look at the whole issue of parenting. The parenting challenge does not fit any notion of how we burden parents, or how parents burden themselves, look at it either way, of what it was like when I went to school, when you went to school. We were in neighborhoods and communities that were real neighborhoods. And even earlier, where I came out of a small community in Texas, this is a college campus, we did not know that white people ran anything until we moved to St. Louis. But then we managed to be in good communities where you had some strong principals. The kids knew each other. Admittedly, I went to Cobrian, I went to Sumner, I went to Couples when it opened. But the kids, white kids who lived in the neighborhood and that we played with, they were going to Couples, we had to go to Cobrian. Unhealthy. Right now we have, you got to bus a kid to get to a school. You got so many blocks that have been taken off of the tax rolls, and school districts are largely funded by state funds, federal funds, and real estate tax funds. But we bring we are so decoupled. Municipal government and its economic development concerns are decoupled from education. Education is decoupled from municipal concerns. There is no serious instruction in the K-12 curriculum that is educating our kids that focuses on their development of character or citizenship. When I was a kid, I could afford to be a kid because you had adults in my neighborhood, Grown Hammett Place between Marcus and Euclid. You had adults, and the children were respectful to the adults. And the adults kind of kept an eye on them and could say something to them and correct them, and they would we would respond
appropriately.
Appropriately. So it's amazing with this transformation in the economic and social landscape of St. Louis that the public schools that serve St. Louis children give no attention, no substantive attention whatsoever to developing the children of today, because that's what we're talking about. We may not think of these children as stakeholders, but they absolutely must be stakeholders, much more than I ever had to be.
But you know, Jack,
when I was K through 12.
Yeah, and when we look at what we see and what we've created based on what we've done to destabilizing families, what we've done to destabilizing the neighborhoods that they grew up in, now we want to punish them. That's all we have for them is punishment. When I came to the district in the early 1970s, there was over 100,000 students. 100,000 students in the St. Louis Public Schools. There were about 115 schools. The ratio, I probably was like 35 to 1, sometimes 38 to 1. We had curriculums that included all kinds of stuff, including foreign language. Okay? When Dr. Keisha Scarlett came a year and a half ago, she got 67 schools, less than 18,000 students. She's got a 12 to 1 ratio, but look at the kids that are left in that district, Jack. These are kids that are poor. They've been plagued by intergenerational poverty. Some of them have mental health issues. They come with trauma. I mean, 12 to 1 probably is still too high. But these are kids that are, commodities, and people are trying to manage them, not trying to teach them, manage them. And to your point about we don't see schools as an integral part of, not just development of the individual, but development of our community and ultimately of our society. It's really startling that we haven't figured that out yet. Really.
There's no good reason, in my view. There is an unhealthy tension between municipal government and the school board. The school board has as its focus, and it's driven largely by Jefferson City Department of Elementary and Secondary Education and the state board, has its focus on the test scores that our students are getting.
Mm-hmm.
And sink or swim, it was a punitive kind of focus. If your students didn't meet the test score gates, then the teacher's job was at stake.
Exactly.
The option of closing the school was at stake. There was no assessment that you would call a root cause assessment focused on looking at the relevant educational variables so that they could get a grip on how to help the teachers help the students succeed.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like we're punishing. It's a punitive measure, like we could squeeze it out of you mm-hmm. in some way. But the reality is the child of today is not the child I was when I was K through 12.
Absolutely not.
This child is caught up with more survival tension in his or her life than I ever experienced. They are really stakeholders in our school, but we don't cultivate them as stakeholders. We don't, for example, clearly, in my view, a school district that is in an urban area should be customizing instruction and citizenship and character development that is responsive to the needs of the community. So that kid is not only a stakeholder, but he or she is an accountable stakeholder. Because we are now in the new order that I would suggest needs to exist, we have a customized core instructional content for K through 12, age appropriate, on development of character and citizenship, with opportunities to use the community as a laboratory supported by community agencies on giving kids experience. One of the things when I was a principal at a middle school, we felt that you had to really kind of grow what you want. We had to create a climate,
mm-hmm.
an educational climate, and a culture that made the students stakeholders in that school climate. And each grade level, students were selected by their classmates to represent them on student advisory groups. So if I wanted to go in, find out what sixth grade think about what's going on, I had a group of students I could meet with.
Mm-hmm.
Seventh grade, same way.
Mm-hmm.
Eighth grade, same way. But the point is, the kids were stakeholders. And what they thought was valued.
Mm-hmm.
There is no reason that the idea of community, I mean, the very concept of community, could not be cultivated in each and every one of our schools so that the idea of community, when you step outside of the school and think in terms of the concept of community, has some relevance to you. And there's a way to do that. But it has to begin with the school board that serves St. Louis City not being preoccupied with what the needs are in some other part of the state as relates to citizenship and care, but what do we need to be doing? The parenting isn't taking place. We have too many dysfunctional households. We have too many parents that themselves were not beneficiaries of strong parenting. That is to say, the kind that sends a child to the school really prepared to function. Or that the whole idea of neighborhood has changed. So I hesitate to use it, but we do have neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
But the school district clearly should have a marriage with the municipal government, whereby what they are doing in citizenship development and character development meshes, corresponds closely, if not perfectly congruent, with what the city needs in terms of teaching our kids how to think and see the world they're part of and how to be accountable in that dynamic. That marriage needs to be tight. It's non-existent. And not only is it a matter of just municipal government and Board of Education, it's every agency, every neighborhood agency. The Urban League, huge role for the Urban League. Used to have a big role back in my day. But Mike is doing a tremendous job in that position. But this is a marriage that our children cannot be treated like what they think doesn't make any difference. They have to do what they're told. Forget it.
Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen.
Because it's a strategic initiative. There is no one, if we don't address this with the earliest kids in elementary and throughout high school and getting them to thinking different and seeing their community different and their role in it differently, we're only going to cultivate more youngsters to go turn to all the ills of our community.
That we want to punish
safety,
them for. That we're ready to punish them for.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Wow.
So that is, you know, that clearly we have, there's a big problem in Jefferson City. You got an obligation to St. Louis. We're taxpayers in St. Louis. Get off this bit of any notion of equal funding and get busy with what are equitable needs that we need to be responding to. Fund the equitable requirement, the equal requirement. When Roberti and Company came to St. Louis, Dr. Hammonds was the superintendent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Mayor Slay was the mayor. And the Post-Dispatch ran an article that the mayor said the St. Louis Public Schools was spending money like drunken sailors.
I remember that.
Okay. And the reality was, the way school budgets work is you have anticipated revenues per quarter based on what your funding authorization is, as you've been told, in the fall of the school year. And so you can't order something exactly when you need it. You have to obligate funds that you expect to receive so that you have deliveries that you need on time for you to use them.
Exactly.
Well, when the superintendent obligated funds that heretofore had been received in a timely way, the state, cooperating with Liberty and Company, the powers in St. Louis, they didn't send the money.
Right.
And we had obligated funds. So, I mean, it was deliberate sabotage. And so the way I look at much of what's taking place that's affecting this bit to recover and get ourselves back on a footing is when we look at all this testing emphasis, and mind you, I think testing that is used constructively as opposed to punitively has a place in what we do. But clearly, somebody has figured out if we can just administer these tests, these black students, they're going to do poorly, we know. We now have hard data that says they, by and large, are inferior. Mm. They're by and large, it feeds that I need data to prove the superiority. Well, we got test data. And I'll say this one thing because it's a subject area that's sickening to me.
I'm going to have to wind this down.
Okay.
And so, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
But the president of the Board of Education, an article was printed in American. The president of the Board of Education at the time was praising, get this, the improvement in black academic performance on the state test. And then in the same paragraph on the same, well, not the same, but in the same column on the same page, it pointed out even though the improvement in black performance was only because white performance was poor.
So it's all relative.
What in the world are you celebrating, and what do you understand about any? That's what testing has done to us.
Right.
It makes us speak and say things that are not intelligent. So
we're going to have to come back. Yes, yes. We need to talk about it.
Because we've got too many things at stake with our young people.
And they are responding in a way that I think is appropriate to what we've done and what we've created for them. Wow. Jack Windham, thank you for joining us today. You have been, as I thought you would, an informative guest that gives us something to think about. Yes, our children are paramount, and they are have been placed at risk by a society that has denigrated them and us for generations. But the struggle continues. This is Jamala Rogers, your host, and I will see you on the battlefield.